The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. James McBride has joined us many times before. He is one of the early One Book, One Philadelphia authors with his national bestseller, The Color of Water. He has brought his jazz band here more than a few times, and along the way he has continued to challenge himself in nearly every literary form, from his journalistic pieces to the aforementioned memoir, to his irreverent and hilarious National Book Award winning novel, The Good Lord Bird. James has also written screenplays, adapted his novel Miracle at St. Anna into a script for Spike Lee, and received the National Humanities Medal from President Obama in 2016. He was last here for his biography of the hardest working man in show business, and tonight he joins us to talk about his first collection of short stories, Five Carat Soul. As one reviewer notes, McBride is such an agile writer that each voice in Five Carat Soul feels authentic and somehow familiar. Taken together, the stories speak, if not directly to one another, to a greater humanity and wisdom we all desire. And I can tell you that the first story alone is worth the price of the book. Please welcome back James McBride.
You like me. You really like me. Thank you very much. So nice to see so many nice people here today. So I was under instructions from a white man just shortly before, not Andy, but another white man who said, you know, when you start talking, just keep it. So that's my friend Vinny Carissimi. He's a lawyer at Pepper Hamilton, so don't go to them if you have legal problems, because he will scrunch you. No, I've known Vinny for 40 years. We used to work at Variety Club Camp. He's that white guy, the other white guy right there. That he's just mad because when we were young, I used to just skywalk on him in the basketball court. That's not true, actually. He would skywalk on me, but who cares? Stereotypes work all the time. In any case, well, thank you for coming. I'm surprised to see so many people here. My star's fading a little bit. I'm 60, you know. I'm not Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know. I don't have any conversations about race to offer you. So, but in any case, my newest book is called Five Carat Soul. And it's about several different stories, and these stories are written over time. They were written over the many years in which, my mother told me if you chew gum and swallow it, your behind will close up, so I won't. I've never swallowed the gum, ever. So. Why did I say that? I'm not. In any case, these stories were written over time. I've had a long and varied writing career. I went to Oberlin, and then I went to Columbia to get a master's in journalism, and then I was a journalist for 9 years, and then I was a musician for 9 years, and I wrote The Color of Water while I was a musician, and I used to travel and go from here to Gary, Indiana, in a van for 12 hours, and guys smoking reefer, and come back with $5. Everything I had, I bought in a truck stop or rest area. And then during that time, I wrote my first book, and then it became a success, and so I vacillated between writing and music since then. But this latest book was written in part to excise the spirit of the James Brown story, which was just a really negative piece of business, really. So some of these stories, a couple of them are new, but most of them were written as I traveled. I wrote, and I'll just Well, I'll just give you a synopsis of each, and then I'll read a little bit, and then I'll answer questions, because I'm under instructions to squench it, keep it tight, because Vinny wants to go get a bean pie. He wants a bean pie. This is the only white man in Philly I know who during the day would drive through the hood to find a bean pie. I mean, God. All right, the first story is called The Underground Railroad Boxcar Set, and it's one of my favorites. Writers probably say that all the time. You know, when they say what's one of my favorites, what they're really saying is like, buy the book. Please buy the book. But it is one of my favorites. Because one time when I was married, I lived in Bucks County. Bucks County. And I used to know a guy who collected toys. And so this story is about a toy collector. And the story is essentially about a guy who's a middle-aged Jewish guy who's going toward his elder years, and he collects antique toys, and he finds the most like valuable toy in the whole world. It's the Underground Railroad Boxcar Set. It's a train about this long with four cars that can run on a track on a single piece of coal at 25 miles an hour for 4 hours. And it was built for General Robert Lee E. by Smith & Wesson under commission for his youngest son. And then when the war first broke out, the Civil War broke out, General Lee had to leave home. And when he left to go to meet with the President, Jefferson Davis, the President of the Confederacy, his son, Graham, died. And right after his son died, the slave who was responsible for taking care of this kid took the train and absconded and left and was never found. And so it was called, and of course General Lee was angry, contacted the Pinkertons and detectives to find this woman, but this slave vanished. And so it was called the Underground Railroad Boxcar Set because it was made for Graham, Graham Lee, who died as a child, and then it made its way on the Underground Railroad box, on the Underground Railroad. Well, in any case, it was never found until this toy collector happens to open a piece of mail, and to his utter shock, he looks at a picture. He sees this little black kid holding the most valuable toy, and he's holding the Underground Railroad boxcar. So this guy, he gets an address, and he finds the house, and he finds the owner of it, and it's this preacher from Springfield Gardens, Queens, a guy from Queens. And he says to him, he's got a briefcase with a bunch of money. He says, I'll give you $90,000 to start. And the guy says, no, you don't have to. You can take it. Just keep it. But I got to pay. No, just keep it. I don't want, you can have it. And so he can't understand why this preacher wants him to just have this thing. So you'll have to read the story to figure out. But the rest of it, you know. The next story is, you can tell I've been doing readings a long time. The next story is a novella. It's called The Five Carat Soul Bottom Bone Band, and it's about a kid, group of kids who come from a black neighborhood. The neighborhood is in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. It's really in Edinburgh. Edinburgh, for those of you, I'm sure there's some people have heard of Edinburgh. Edinburgh produced C. Vivian Stringer, who's the coach of the, I think, Rutgers. But most of my brother-in-law grew up in Edinburgh. And he used to talk about Edinburgh all the time and how it was this steel town. The blacks lived here and the whites lived here. And, you know, they none of them had money and the plants closed and they were all. But they had this, you know, they had a relationship. So this story is about a group of kids who are in this R&B band, like a soul band in the 60s. And it's told from the perspective of a 12-year-old boy named Butter. And these stories are based on stories that I've heard or knew or came across, or sometimes they just happen. The first one's called Buck Boy, and it's about a little kid, about a 17-year-old kid named Buck Boy who gets shot by a Korean merchant and the ensuing business that happens after Buck Boy gets shot. Ray Ray's Picture Box is about a mentally disabled boy named Ray Ray who gets a box of pornographic pictures that he steals from his father and gives them to like a neighborhood bully who sells them to all the gangs and stuff. And then the father finds out. Blub is about a little boy who, they called him Blub, but it's really about a romance between a boy who gets into big trouble and the storyteller's little sister, Sissy. And Goat is about the fastest kid in the bottom. Goat is the fastest little boy in the bottom, and he's just, he run, he can beat everybody in the bottom. And then he goes to the white school. He could beat the white kids, and he becomes a track star. But it's really about Goat's mother, and her name is Mrs. Shays, because Goat is discovered by his teacher in this all, quote-unquote, colored school, who, you know, he takes him around. She needs his birth certificate, and so she has to get his birth certificate from his mother. And his mother says, well, I don't have no birth certificate for him. She says, why not? She says, well, I'm from Kentucky, you know, and you know, they don't have birth certificates for black folks now. She says, well, you got birth certificate. It's on file somewhere. And the mother says, no, I filed cotton in a bag. That's the only filing. And it talks about that. It's really about her, and it's about the Vietnam War and its effect on this community. Father Abe is about a mixed-race boy who believes that Abraham Lincoln's his father. Abraham Lincoln is my dad. Yes, he is my father. And just want you to know that Abraham Lincoln is my father. No, just kidding. And this boy comes upon a group of Union soldiers, and their response to the kid and the discourse between the kid and the soldiers is really the selling point in this story. The Moaning Bench is about, it's one of my favorite stories. It's about a boxer who is at the gates of hell. And he and four others are in the gatekeeper's domain. And the gatekeeper says to them, you know, welcome to my house. At your last minute, just before you stopped paying taxes for good, somebody decided that, you know, you had a woman, you know, so tell me your story and hurry up, because I've been hearing excuses since the ancient druids. So get it on and let's get it over with, because, you know, and there's a door behind him in this, they can hear screaming and howling. So one by one, the first three people stand up, and he just whoops on them bad. Like the first one's a real estate developer, he just dices them. And then the next one is a woman who was having an affair, and he just cuts it to pieces. And another's a coal miner, and he talks about his double chin, and you guys are humping your cousin, you're going there. And they go all through this, and the coal miner gets pissed off, which is important to remember. And then the fourth one is a little girl, and he starts woofing on her, you shouldn't have run in. And he starts woofing on her so bad that the fifth person who's waiting to teach, because they have to take the Terry Clove Roths, or the fifth person stands up, and he's this boxer. The splendid, gigantic, brown, glistening boxer with boxing gloves on, who had been knocked out in round 7, and here he is with this guy. And the boxer just lets him have it. And they go at it, the two of them. They start woofing on each other, and then they end up having a boxing match. And they're fighting for basically, you know, the souls of the boxer and the people. And then you have to read what happens. The Fishman Angel is a true story. It's another Abe Lincoln story. It's based on Abraham Lincoln's relationship. Well, you know, I know George, Bartos? Who wrote, George Saunders wrote a book of short stories about Abraham Lincoln, but I didn't, could you stop videotaping, mister? Yeah. George Saunders wrote a book about Abraham Lincoln and his son Willie, but this story was written long ago. Not that George Saunders is not, he's very talented. But I just don't want you to think I'm copying his style or anything. This story begins with Abraham Lincoln going to the stall of his son. For those of you who don't know, Abraham Lincoln had a son named Willie that he loved dearly. And Willie got sick, and there was nothing that could be done for him. They had the best doctors in the land, but he died. And the sight of Abraham Lincoln staggering around the walls of the White House, sobbing, saying he's gone, was something that most people, most of the administration staff, would never forget. Of course, if the current president fell down a flight of stairs, I don't know that how many of you would be staggering along, but that's another story entirely. But in any case, there was great concern among Abraham Lincoln's staff that because he would go on long solitary walks by himself, and they knew that people wanted to assassinate him and so forth. So he goes out to a stall one night by himself, and he sees his son's pony, Willie, and he goes and he does this nightly ritual of cleaning the pony and feed him an apple. And as he does this, he just breaks down, he starts to sob, and then he hears footsteps, so he hides. And when he hides, his coachman enters, and the stable hand enters, and then he overhears the conversation between these two men. And during that discourse, he hears one of them tell this story about the Fishman Angel, which is a true story that I read in an account by an African-American slave woman who told this story about a fishman angel that she saw. And the four magic words that the fishman angel said to her become part of Abraham Lincoln's lore. And you'll just have to read the story to see what those four magic words are. And then finally, Mr. P and the Wind is about a lion in a zoo in Washington, D.C. And I wrote that one for my nephews when I was working at the Washington Post in the style section there. I took my nephews to see the animals in the zoo. And they were so depressed afterwards that I wrote this story for them. And it's told from the perspective of the lion. And I should also add that around the time I wrote this story, there was a gorilla in the Philadelphia Zoo who died. I think the gorilla's name was Mamsie. What was it? Massa. Yeah, well, whatever. But there's no Massa in this story, I can tell you that. But I remember that. I remember that because Clark de Leon, is that his name? Clark de Leon? He wrote in his column, Massa's in the cold, cold ground. I remember reading that. And I said, well, you know, he's going to get some letters behind that. But I do, but I was affected by the sight of those animals in the zoo in Washington, D.C., and my nephews were so depressed afterwards. They were young. They were like 8 and 10 or something, you know. So I wrote this story for them. So I'll begin reading a little bit of this story. This story is told from the perspective of the lion. And one of the things that's interesting about this story is that, by the way, all these stories, I sent most of them, I submitted to magazines, and they were never published. Shall I name the magazines? I shall not. But the thing about this story was that it, and these stories in general, is that this is really where I live in terms of writing. I mean, because creative fiction, you know, real good fiction, is like jazz in the sense that either you can really do it or you just can't, you know. And that really, for me, it's a good place to be because it takes me out of the realm of being just another writer trying to write a novel. And it puts me before people like yourselves who know good writing. And so that's why this book and the previous book have been so important to me personally. Because before that, I was always a nonfiction writer. Even after I'd written novels, I was never really considered a novelist until I won the National Book Award, which was like a fluke. I'll take it, you know. But in any case, the voice of the good Lord Byrd really, looking back, began here. And this story was written more than 30 years ago. And this is the lion talking. And this is and Mr. P and the Wind is a novella, so there are four chapters. And this is the first chapter. And this chapter is called The 24th Hour, and this is how it begins. I am a lion. I live in a zoo. But I was once a free lion and never forgot it. Many years ago, before I was captured and brung here, I knowed a lion who ate a man. His name was Box. Now, I don't know how Box come to that name, for lions got their own names for their own purpose, and that name was a puzzlement to me. Box is a human name, you see, and it stands to reason that maybe a human gave him that name. However it happened, or whether Box got a reason for telling it or not telling it, it ain't my business to know. For most lions know that man things often ain't got no purpose, and no creature of the jungle is going to sniff around something that ain't purposeful, especially something big as a name. For lions got their own names that's particular to them, like Monkey Tricked Him, or His Wife Don't Visit, or Feet Smell Funny, or Don't Trust Her Because She's a Son, or Orange Head, and all like that. For example, humans call me Hal, but my real name is Get Along, Go Along. No animal in his right mind would call me Hal unless they want me lunching on their guts. But Box come to his name some kind of way. That was his first mistake, I think, to call himself by a man name when he had his own mother called name. I never knew Box's real name, by the way. Never stupid enough to ask, neither. For Box was what you call a plain old dry long soul lion. He was a hard lion, set in his ways. He didn't take no shit off nobody. Now, I heard many a story told to me when I was a cub running free back yonder in the plains of Africa, and a bunch of them stories was lies. For animals ain't no different than man that way. The story starts out one way, and 5 days later, it grows tree branches and leaves, and before you know it, it's the size of a mountain with caves and rocks, and you can't see the top or bottom of the thing while you're standing on it. But Box told me this story himself, and Box wasn't the type to lie. This is what Box told me. He was coming through the jungle one day, and a hunter surprised him, got the drop on him. Box walked right past him, never smelled him or sensed him, nothing. That man jumped out of a bush behind Box holding a spear with dead lion scent all over it. He had Box dead to rights. He had old Box cold. wasn't nothing Box could do. Box knew his head was going to hang from the wall of the man's lair for the rest of the time while the man apologized to Box and all his relatives for taking his life and so forth. For that's how the old-time hunters did it. They put you to the big sleep and thank your relatives afterwards by praying and so forth so your souls can live together for the rest of time while he uses your claws as plates for his smoking sticks and so forth. There wasn't nothing Box could do, so he said this to himself, "It is a good day to die," and turned on man and waited to sleep. But this man knew too much. Instead of throwing his spear when Box turned on him, the man spoke to Box in thought speak. Know what he said? He said this, "I know it ain't your 24th hour." Well, that threw old Box. I don't know what threw old Box more, man talking in thought speak, which is how animals speak, or man speaking about the 24th hour. Both had never happened to Box before, but man spouting off about that 24th hour put the thing in a different light. So that's how that story begins. And you have to read about, you know, with the 24th, blah, blah, blah. And then finally, I'll just read a little bit of the beginning story from this set of stories, and then you can... And this is a different voice. This is a 60-odd, 65-odd-year-old Jewish toy collector who lives in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And he's talking about his life and how he came upon the Underground Railroad boxcar set. Begins as follows. "I sell vintage toys, all kinds of toys. I sell sheep that belch popcorn, dolls that whisper secrets, paper mache Santa Clauses, Halloween masks, little Bo Peeps, and puppets. I sell toy parrots that say, 'Here comes a nigger.' 1823 fire engines that say toot, and wind-up clocks from 1834 that say, 'Time's up, Gramps.' I sell tricycles from the Depression, toy coffee grinders from World War II France, and two types of the original 1964 Rock'em Sock'em robots, including one that looks like Peter O'Toole and another that looks just like Sammy Davis Jr. I sell tin soldiers, steel trains, wooden cars, cardboard airplanes, ceramic piggy banks, and pinball machines. If it's a vintage toy, I sell it. I am a sole proprietor. I buy toys on commission from collectors. They love me. Toy collecting is a small world, and in that world, I am Pete Rose, Henry Aaron, and the Babe, all rolled into one. My batting record over the last 20 years is close to 1,000. I have never lost a client. No one can resist my blend of knowledge, perception, and most of all, profit. No one can resist my charms. No one, that is, except one. I first heard of Reverend Spurgeon Hart by way of an old friend." And on, he tells us about Reverend Spurgeon Hart. What can I say? I'm going to answer questions now. I don't want, you know, yiggity yak, you know, you look, I'm under orders here. So anyway, I'll open the floor to questions now. If you have any, yes, Zainab Ali?
I've known you for a very long time, but I've always wanted to ask you how you deal with, or do you ever have writer's block? And how do you get yourself out of that?
There's no such thing as writer's block, really. Writer's block usually, I mean, when you're caught, when you're stuck, it's usually because you don't have enough information. So what I do is, to be honest with you, I come to the Philadelphia Free Library. And I pick up more books. And I get more information. I do a lot of my research in this library. And that's what I do. I don't really believe in. There's no such thing as writer's block. What happens is if you're doing fiction, you run out of. Your characters aren't moving around because they won't go because you don't have enough. You're not feeding them enough, and they're not feeding you enough. You have to know who these characters are in order for them to get moving. If it's nonfiction, there's absolutely no reason why you should be stuck. Then it's just a question of structure, because nonfiction has a certain set of facts that, you know, that determine what you do and when you do them. In that case, it's really about story structure. Really, story structure is really, really the key to everything. Really, artistically, it doesn't matter what it is: painting, music. Writing, it's really about the structure. If you're good enough, then you can force or persuade the viewer, listener, reader to accept your message. The question is there enough humanity in what you have to offer so they can connect?
I read Color of Water, and I want to know, how is your mother?
Oh, my mother passed away in 2010.
Okay, I hear that. Are you originally from here? Do you live here?
No. No, I'm from New York. I'm from Brooklyn, New York, originally. My mother came to Philly when I was like my freshman year at Oberlin College.
Okay.
She moved to Philly like in the middle of the school year. She moved to Germantown.
Okay.
And so when I came home from school, I came here, and that's how I got. But I've had a lot of family. I have two sisters who live in Philly. I've had a lot of family in Philly. My brother Dennis went to medical school here. My brother Billy lived here. I have a lot of family still in Philly, you know. And, you know, I love Philly. I think it's a great city. I mean, I remember the days of Milton and John Street. That's how far back, you know. I mean, those were some wild days. And Joseph Coleman and the city council. I mean, you know, wow, man. Whew. I mean, those were some. Was it a better city back then? You know. But I know musically, this has always been a great home for me. And, I learned how to play jazz here in Philly. I saw something in Philly that most people wouldn't appreciate unless you're from Philly. There was a tenor player here named Hank Mobley. He was a great horn player. He played with Miles Davis for years. And I dedicate this book to Sonny Rollins, you know, because I know Mr. Rollins. I talk to him just about every week. He's just so deep. He's so profound. And this idea of what the bigger picture is something that, you know, I really agree with and believe in. But when I was about 20 years old, I was home from Oberlin here. And I was at a jam session in West Philly. And at the bar was the great Sonny Rollins. And Hank Mobley. And so he was taken there by a tenor player named Charlie Cunningham, who I believe is still alive. And so we were all gathered around Hank Mobley talking to him, you know, because this was Hank Mobley. I mean, this is the guy who played, he's a great composer. If you knew jazz, you knew that Hank Mobley was one of the great jazzmen of that ever came from Philadelphia. All right, well, so I was talking to him, you know, and he was saying, well, you know, I don't play that much anymore. You could see he was just sick and emaciated, and obviously alcohol had taken its toll. And then he stood up, and so the band was playing, we all jamming, and then somebody finally talked him into playing, and Hank Mobley stood, they gave him a horn, and the band broke out, boom, 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 and they were burning, and he picked up the horn, and he put his mouth to the horn, and he couldn't play. I mean, every once in a moment, you know, there was like a flash of the magic, and then it was gone. And I tell you, I grew up right there. And you know something? Really, not much has changed here in Philadelphia in terms of music. You know, Aretha Franklin was just here. I helped contract that band when Aretha was here. And you know, when Aretha came here, if she hadn't insisted that the horn players in her group be African-American, they would not have been. The Philadelphia Orchestra is as white now as it was 45 years ago, when I was walking around here at 18, and so was the Philly Pops. And then white folks wonder why black people are always mad about something. You're going to tell me, oh, in the last 40 years that there hasn't been like one or two string players that have come out of some school somewhere who are qualified to play in the Philadelphia Orchestra? Or the Philly Pops, which plays jazz, they can't find four or five more in Philadelphia? You know, when Christian McBride leaves this town and he has to go to New York City to make a living, the greatest living bass player ever?
Yes.
You know? There's nothing in this town that says, you know, Lee Morgan lived here. I mean, John Cole, you know, there's kind of a superstar thing that happens in art, in both writing and especially in music. And it's this. They used to say in baseball that no outfielders who were black were less than 300 hitters. I never understood that when I was a young man. But now I realize what they were saying. In baseball, if you hit 300, that means you can hit the heck out of the ball. But, and you know, you never saw black outfielders who were less than 300 hitters. You had to be excellent. But those rules don't apply to music in Philadelphia. It's still 1932 here, I'm sorry to say. It's still 1932 here in the music business. I mean, that's just fact. I'm not conjecturing, and I'm not trying to make you feel bad. But that's just how it is. And so I talk about this kind of stuff with Sonny Rollins, you know, because he's looking for a place to park his some of his riches, you know. Now, he's not, like, super rich. And we talk about these kinds of things. And it affected me a lot, him, because his attitude towards it is that you just do the best you can with whatever you have, and let the God you believe in, which I happen to believe in, just the old-fashioned God, you know, the one that on Sunday morning, the one who shows up between like 11 and 1, you know? I mean, that's the one that works for me. I mean, whatever works for you, I mean, you know. Ours usually shows up between 11 and 1. Around 12:15, the minister's like full, like, brah, brah. It doesn't matter that he preaches the same sermon because I don't listen to him nowhere. It's just the spirit of it, you know, wah, wah, and then he winds it down. Somewhere or another, he's got a clock somewhere up there that says, you know, does it ever occur to you like the ministers tell the same story every week? Like, why don't these guys like say anything else like when I was 17, when I was 7 growing up in Norfolk, Virginia? This minister, every time he says, you know, I was 7 years old, I was a boy. I was walking down the road in Virginia, Norfolk, Virginia, 1949. I'm like, didn't he say this last week? But anyway, I digress. Next question.
This is not to suggest that we've come a very long way, but the Philadelphia Orchestra actually has an African-American bass player, viola player, a violinist. Yeah, and I can't think of their names. Do you know their names? But so I just want you to know, I know they didn't have those three back in the 40s, and I know they should have more, but they do have those three at least at this time.
Well, we don't want to get into that now, but let me...
You brought it up, so all right, well, just correcting.
All right, well, you know what? When you write books and people listen to you, you can correct people, okay? Let me just say this. Listen, in 40 years, if all they can find is a bassist and a violinist and an oboist, they should be ashamed of themselves. Really. I mean, okay, some of my facts are a little bit wrong. So what? I mean, I'm thinking, you know, there was a trumpet player here named Joe Wilder who talked about his experiences in Philadelphia. He talked about what he happened to him when he would come to play, and how he was stopped and searched by the cop. You have no idea the humiliation that some of these black musicians in this town feel. I'm expressing to you what I know from my own experience and from some of the most talented musicians I have ever met. Yes, you're right. I know the bass player. I know about these musicians. I met the bass player. Great, great player. You know, what he's doing in the community, I don't know. But I know for a fact that it's a shame that an orchestra this big and a city this big has such a small representation of musicians. I mean, it's just...
I prefaced my statement
with that. Well, okay, well, I'm glad you prefaced it, but, you know, now that people know it, they know why I stand on it. Listen, this is what happened. I'm going to tell you what happened. When Jonathan Demme died, and you all of you know him, he died this year, and he used to call me all the time, and he used to say, James, I'm going to South Dakota, come on with me. And I said, no, I'm going to New Orleans. Nah, you know, he did a film about New Orleans, and I scored it, I did the music. I just didn't want, I said, I got to stay out of that, man. I don't want to get into politics. And then I went to his funeral. His funeral had about 200 people there. It was a private service. And Edwige Dandekot, the writer, stood up. And I didn't speak. His wife asked me to do the music, so I brought in great musicians. A lot of great musicians came. Bruce Springsteen sang. It was great. And then as Edwige Dandekot spoke, and she said, because we all lived in Nyack at the same time, and she said, when John used to walk his daughter to school, and when he walked his daughter to school, there was a Haitian lady who used to see him, and he'd walk her back and forth to school every day. And she said, the lady said to Edwige, you know, I used to pray for him every day that God would give him a job because he was such a nice man. And I would see him in the middle of the day. I'd say, Lord, please give him a job because he needs a job so bad. And, you know, she ended up becoming an extra on his films. And he always made sure that his films were in every aspect that he could, were representative of a wider spectrum of the real America that exists. And when Edwige told that story, that was the one time I just broke down. It really affected me. And I decided then that I was not going to be quiet about this kind of stuff no more. So you're right. I don't mean to disrespect you, ma'am. You spoke the truth. But the truth is that it is an absolute embarrassment that a city this size is still living in 1932 when it comes to the hiring of black musicians in the pops, the string orchestra, and the wider orchestra. That's just, I've read stories about Eugene Ormandy. I used to read about him, and he used to conduct the Philadelphia Orchestra in the street, in the Rittenhouse Square. That's great. 10 blocks from there, kids were starving to death, and there's so many talented people that come from this city, and nobody does anything about it. You know why? Because a black musician who's stupid enough to open his mouth on that subject here will never work. See, I'm impervious to that, but I'm speaking for a lot of people when I tell you that it's a disgrace and it should change. And you can say I said it in capital letters. Now let's get back to literature. Any more questions about writing and literature? Yes, sir?
You know who you're quoting in terms of ideas? Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard said what you said in his time. And what he said was, you should call an idiot. So Kierkegaard said that way back, right? I've been talking to folks about things happening now. I have wonderful friends, and they're always saying, we got to be nice. But Kierkegaard said, you got to call a fool a fool. If not, everybody says, be nice.
Well, you make a good point. You know, I have a friend named David Preston. Those of you who read the Philadelphia Inquirer magazine story some years back, David Preston is an editor here in Philadelphia, and he's a great writer. His mother was a both his parents were Holocaust survivors. And David said to me before the election, he said, Donald Trump is going to win. And we had a big argument about that. And I said, why? He said, because there's a lot of people who say they're not going to vote for him, they're going to vote for him anyway. So I went out and picked up a copy of The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. I read it just before the election, the book by William Shirer. And it's really worth reading for everyone here. Because this is really, you know, it's not about propaganda and it's not about Fox. The war has already begun. We've had 70 years of pretty benign life in this country. And any Jewish person who votes for Donald Trump needs their heads examined. What do you think these right-wing people are talking about? They're not talking about Mexicans. They don't worry about Mexicans. They're worried about Jewish people. People who are Jewish who think anti-Semitism is gone are just living in a different world. And so if we're not active, if we're not outspoken, if we're not ready to take care of business, then we will suffer as a nation. So I can no longer remain mute on these points because the writers are the first ones they come get anyway. And you know what? Honest to Jesus, God hears me saying it. I'll be proud if they came and got me. Really, because, you know, when I did Miracle of St. Anna, when I went to Italy, and I studied the war from the perspective of the Italians, interesting thing happened. Every Italian I spoke to, they were all partigiani. All their grandfathers were partisans. Oh, my grandfather was a partigiani. Everyone, my grandmother, they were all partisans, so I guess nobody fought against the Germans. You know, they were all partigiani, so, I mean, you know, they were all allies. But the fact is, Italy broke into civil war during World War II. And the Italians suffered horribly. And the partigiani were the poor people. They were the quote-unquote peasants and the students. That was it. And some brave villagers. That was it. But General William J. McCaffrey, who ran the 92nd Division, he was a white guy. He was the father of Barry McCaffrey, who later became the commander of the American forces in Europe and in Iraq. He said something that was very interesting. He said, when the war ended, he said, I had all my troops in Genoa. And we returned the ashes of Christopher Columbus, and then I called him in. The war was over. He said, the very next day, I had to send them out again. And he said, you know why? Because there was so much retribution. There were murders in the street. People remembered. They remembered what happened during the war. People will remember what happened during this time, and they're going to remember where you stood. They will not forget. It's no longer a question of discourse. We have to force the other 40% into line. There's no more talking now. They have to be forced into line. Now, I'm not saying take out a gun and shoot anybody, but we're already getting shot ourselves. I mean, it's already a war of weapons. So, you know, how that force happens, I don't know, but that's where the discourse should be. This is not a conversation about race anymore. It never was. We get along pretty good in Philadelphia. I mean, we have our issues, you know. I hate you, you hate me, we are one family. But, you know, I mean, we have our issues, but we know what the big story is. And Philadelphia is a place where people try hard to do the right thing, in part because of the history of this town. This is the cradle of American freedom. You know, I did a concert with the Philadelphia Boys Choir last I can't remember now. It's been a few months. And, you know, they called me and they said, we want you to do a story about Underground Railroad, the Underground Railroad book by, who wrote that book? Who? Colson Whitehead. Colson African American Head wrote it, you know. And so, no, just kidding. So I said, why do you want to do that book? And this is Philadelphia. That takes place in Georgia. You can do it. You want to do Underground Railroad. This is the capital. This is the station here. This was where everyone came. William Still's house is down the street. So they said, okay, so we did that. And it really worked out. It was good.
I wanted to know, since you brought up Donald Trump and you talked about how this is no longer about just discourse, I guess I wanted to hear your thoughts about the whole issue surrounding freedom of speech. Because I know since we live in such a so-called liberal Philadelphia, there's constantly people talking about how we need to listen to the other side, we need to converse with them, we have to, you know, be well-grounded in this whole American liberal idea of freedom of speech. So I wanted to know what your perspective is as a writer.
Ooh. Can we make a pact that we would talk about writing and the book after this? Some of this stuff, see, I don't have Twitter and I don't have a television, so I don't, you know, the Twittering and figuring and all that kind of stuff. I don't have Facebook, so I don't hear a lot of the discourse about, you know, the dissension. That's a difficult question to answer. I think the real question to ask yourself is who was running the FCC when that immigrant Rudolph, what's his name, God owns it, Rudolph Murdoch, got his license to start Fox Television. I mean, if you're going to ask those kind, you know, like, what's an immigrant? I mean, what's a Mexican? What's an Indian? What does Asian mean? I mean, these terms don't mean anything. In terms of freedom of expression, I'm glad that everyone has a right to express themselves freely, but I think the smart thing to do would be to subscribe to the Philadelphia Daily News and the Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times, because a lot of this, you know, the whole game is to flood you with misinformation and nonsense so you don't figure out what's going on. You know the Eagles won, and you know the running back, and they kneel down and all. I don't even pay attention to that, you know. Really, I don't care. I don't know anything about it. I mean, I follow the Sixers because, you know, I used to see the white man. I used to skywalk. I just, But I just mostly read about it because I don't have a television. I just think the freedom of expression is everyone can say what they want to say. This is the real issue is this. It's not a sin to express yourself freely. It's not a sin to express yourself or call. You can call someone fake news. If you're too stupid to figure out what the real news is, then you deserve to be governed by somebody who tells you what to do. But the real issue is if someone tells you that, if you acknowledge someone's pain and then do nothing about it, then something's wrong with you. And that's really that's really the problem. And that's a problem that's universal. And it's a Democratic one and a Republican. You know, you acknowledge the problem, but you do nothing about it. And that goes back to the argument that I was having, or the discourse I was having with the lady with the Afro, you know, which I'm sorry if I insulted you. I truly apologize. But that's really the issue. If you know what the problem is and you find a way to kick the can down the road, who are you? You know, you don't count. You've got to be moved out the way. It doesn't matter who you are, what color you are. Look, when I was working at Variety Club Camp, you know, Vinny was there. Vinny and I were counselors at Variety Club Camp. Variety Club Camp was a camp for handicapped kids, and Vinny was the head counselor. And that camp was the United Nations, and this is in the 70s. And so it was run by a guy named Cy Friend. Cy at the time had to, I don't know if I can say this or not, but just, Cy at the time was gay. And he had to keep that a secret. That was a big secret. Nobody knew about it. A couple people knew, but not many. And it was a big secret, and it was a secret for a long time. And you know why? Because people like Vinny and some of the other people there, whatever their color, knew that if the parents and the trustees of that camp, some of them who just, you know, looked the other way, but some of them parents found out, they would get rid of him. And that would be the end, because they saw how that camp changed the lives of those kids. And I have not been friends with Vinny for 40 years because he's a knuckle. Them kids loved him. he would go to jail now for what he did with those kids. He would take them on hikes down 202. He would take them on the road. And they would cry at the end of camp. They would, and they were supposed to come until they were 13. They would stay till they were 19, 20. I'm not lying. I swear to God. Because someone saw a problem, acknowledged it, and did something. The hell with the law. This is what we're going to do. That's it. Now, you know, you're not going to put this lawyer from Pepper Hamilton in jail now. But my point is that even after the camp finished, the staffers there always knew, and some of them became old and died, if they had they had four or five people they could call, if they had a problem, they had a medical problem, there was one guy, a doctor, none of, if they had a legal problem, they could call Vinny and it would get done, because we all had the understanding that Cy Friend put together something special. He put together something special. And there's not even a plaque in this town. There's not one small plaque in this town to show what this great, great gay man did, because he was gay. Now, you can't be a writer and walk around with that kind of knowledge and not feel a little bit pissed off. You can't be a decent person and know people like Joe Wilder, the great trumpet player, and how he was so disgraced and just declassified after spending hours and hours in the practice room and not even given a shot to play in one of the greatest orchestras in this country. And hear those stories. You cannot hear that and not be a little angry. And you cannot watch the rise of Donald Trump and say to yourself, having been to Europe, having studied some of the Holocaust, and understanding the pain and potency of what Jewish life is, and say to yourself, what Jewish person would actually work in his administration? What is that guy Steve Harvey doing in the White House? This is a guy who's a millionaire, and he goes to the White House, black guy, and then after he comes out, he says, oh, it's all right, I lived in the hood. What does that have to do with anything? You're just a fool. And so that's my freedom answer to your question. I hope I answered it properly. Can we just talk about this book a little bit more? I mean, the publisher, really, I'm trying to sell it here. I mean, I got apples, I got bananas, whatever you want, you know? Yes? All right, one more.
Can you tell us what you love? What about writing do you love so much? I mean, what is it that gets you? Regardless of what you write, fiction, nonfiction, I don't care. But what is it that gets your soul and your heart about writing?
Well, it gives me a place to put, because you're only limited by your imagination. You know, fiction, you're only limited by imagination. You can imagine things that you wish happened, and then you can try to make them. Sometimes they happen. You know, the Toy Story here, you know, wonderful things happen. So it gives you, it gives you a license, like James Bond has a license to kill. You have a license to thrill, you know. You can take people places that let them forget how difficult life is for them now. And that's what books always did for me. They gave me a place to go, you know. Even music doesn't do that. Music, you need a quiet, you got to think, you know. It's E flat, I mean, you know, key of B, five sharps, whoa, man. And, you know, but a good story will, you know, it takes you, and you relate to the character, and you see yourself, and you understand why people do what they do. And so you're constantly trying to show people and not tell them. So I did a little bit too much telling today, and I apologize for that. But you're really just trying to show people what happens and then let them decide for themselves what is right. Because if they decide for themselves, they'll do the right thing. I mean, my writing and my entire artistic life is based on the premise that if we have the choice, we do the right thing. Now, there are some philosophers like Nietzsche who's not quite in accordance with what I agree with. But I think that we are very resilient country, and I trust people who read books to do the right thing. So when I sit down to write books, there's a freedom that doesn't exist like when you're doing screenplays or something. You know, you can arc it out so that good things happen to people who deserve it in a world where villains often succeed and heroes sometimes die. And so that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. Well, I think our time is up, but thank you very much for coming out, and really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.